Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
I am your host, Chris Martinson, and today we're going to be talking about housing and the many and various housing bubbles that exist across the globe. Housing bubble, you say? Yep. Remember, a bubble exists when asset prices rise beyond what incomes can sustain. That's my definition. I think it's a good workable one. In housing, my rules of thumb are these. A ratio of median income to median house prices is healthy when it's in the range of 2.5 to 3.5. In other words, if the median household income was $50,000, then we'd expect the median house prices ought to be in the range of $125,000 to $175,000. By the time that ratio stretches to around 5, I consider that to be the beginnings of certified bubble territory. By the time that ratio climbs to 8 or more, you have a silly bubble on your hands. One that will end in tears for a lot of people, especially those who took out home equity lines of credit or otherwise fell for the stupid banker blather about tapping your equity or taking advantage of the wealth effect. So let's give one example. In Toronto, Canada today, the median income for the metro region is $78,373. So we'll call that $78,000. That means a healthy housing market would be priced for the median house somewhere between $195,000 and $275,000, right? That makes sense. Well, let's turn now to look at the average home selling price in Toronto. What would that be? It's $825,000, giving us a ridiculous ratio of 10.6. However, if you actually wanted a detached home in Toronto, then the selling price for those vaults to $1.35 million, yielding a ratio of 17.3. Bubble territory? Well, you decide. Here today to discuss all things housing bubble related is Ben Jones, proprietor of thehousingbubbleblog.com. Ben's been tracking housing markets and bubbles for a long time in his excellent blog. Great way to track the ups and the downs of housing. Welcome to the program, Ben.
Thank you.
It's good to have you. So, Ben, before we really dive into housing, could you please tell people, you know, about your background and how you got interested in tracking housing bubbles?
The 1980s in Texas, I was studying real estate, and we had a big real estate bubble that popped, and it was devastating. You know, all the banks failed, the SNLs. And then in 1998, I moved to Austin, Texas, and became aware of a housing bubble there. At that time, it was kind of a dot-com thing related. And then that popped. And I moved to Arizona in 2003, Sedona, Arizona. And I just kind of parachuted in, and everybody was just gaga about housing. I had a guy sidle up to me one day and told me his house was going up $10,000 a month.
Yeah.
And we're not talking about fancy houses, you know. And so became concerned. In 2004, I started the Housing Bubble blog and went from there. And, you know, of course, within 2 or 3 years in Sedona, it was a disaster. And, you know, tell you the truth, it's really disappointing that we're back here in this situation that we're in.
Well, I would certainly agree with that, because if we look at the history of bubbles, whether they were tulip bulbs, swampland, railroads, it usually took a little over a generation to forget the painful lessons. And I'm astonished, Ben, that we had an internet stock bubble in 2000, a housing bubble in 2007, and we're here again. I think this shows that whatever people are up to today, maintaining a sense of perspective, history, and memory is just not part of it. I did not expect us to get back here again so soon.
Well, that brings up an important point that we've talked about a few times on my blog, that I think that this is the same bubble. For instance, in Texas, when everything got wiped out in the 80s, the term speculative building was a dirty word. mm-hmm. for decades. And the fact that we jumped right back into, you know, these TV reality shows about flipping houses and stuff like that, I think that shows that this was, that the speculative frenzy wasn't extinguished by the collapse, you know, last decade. So I think it's the same bubble.
Well, no, I would agree with that. And I think that's really, when we talk about what the central banks were up to, we could constrain it to the Federal Reserve if we want, but I prefer to look at all the world central banks because this is a global liquidity phenomenon now. But one of the things they clearly had to do was they had to maintain that bubble fervor, because I actually trace this. When people say, oh, there was this major housing bubble that burst, that was the pain. I said, no, that was a side bubble. The main bubble is this one that's been blown since the mid-1980s, and it's centered on this ridiculous idea that you can constantly expand debts faster than incomes taken nationally or globally. That would be the global amount of debt to global GDP. Nationally, it would be national debt to national GDP. At the household level, it's your household income to your own debt levels, whatever it is. But as a household, we know, Ben, that's a dumb idea, right? I can't expand my debts faster than my income forever. I have a math problem pretty soon. Somehow we fell for the story in the central banks. The Federal Reserve is the main defender of this idea that what we need to do as a nation is continually, perpetually, forever have our debts grow faster than our income. Where do you fall on that particular story? I'm sure you're tracking the central bank's shenanigans too, right?
You're right. Yeah, I think if you chase it down to where it really started, it probably was in the 80s. And for instance, from 86 to 89, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac doubled their mortgage portfolios. So that's probably where the genesis of the whole thing is. And this whole idea that houses, well, in other words, why housing? Well, because everybody's got to live somewhere, and it's a way to create this idea, this wealth effect, in as many households as possible. And so you've got, now you've got houses that were bought for built for $25,000, $40,000, now trading for $1 million or $1 million, whatever. Sure, people feel really wealthy, and dollars kind of become meaningless, you know, and like you said, debt becomes meaningless. And when you were talking about incomes to housing prices, there was a report that came out, I don't know, a couple of years ago, that the most expensive neighborhoods in the country actually had the lowest incomes to house prices. And I think that that to me was like really telling. I mean, like, the one that I remember the most was Mercer Island in Washington, was the highest. It had 11. The house prices were 11 to 1 to the incomes. So the every single, it wasn't Detroit. It wasn't, you know, the slums of this area or Ohio. It was the most expensive neighborhoods had the lowest incomes to housing ratios. And the report, you know, was without any irony. You know, like, wow, you know, these people are really wealthy. It's like, no, they're not. Their houses are just way higher than their incomes.
You know, Ben, a really important point that I don't know why it had to be drilled into me this way, because if you just live out here in the world of receiving your news from the newspapers, you will get that message, which is that, oh, look, these people are wealthier because their houses are going up in price. And so that whole thing is just marketed constantly. It says your house is an asset. Your house is an asset. Well, you know, I've been hanging out with Robert Kiyosaki, and I think it was probably the third time I heard him say the same story, but he drilled it into me finally that your house is not an asset. An asset puts cash in your pocket. If you really examine what a house is, it's a major cost center for everybody if you're living in it, right? You've got taxes, which are going through the roof in a lot of locations. You've got, of course, all the maintenance. You've got insurance. You've got whatever interest payments you've got going on. This thing is a major cash sucking machine, a money pit. Therefore, it's not an asset. And somehow that all got reversed into this idea that your house is an asset. But I think we can expose this. Let's imagine somebody in Mercer Island. They decide to sell their house. So now they're rich. But what do they have? What would they do with that? Well, now they have to. The only way you can tap that equity is to move to a place with lower cost housing and buy another money pit, right? And hopefully capture some gains difference. But otherwise, it's not possible by definition for everybody to get wealthy because their houses go up in price because everybody's got to live somewhere. I the whole thing just falls apart as soon as you look at it, even slightly rigorously, I think.
Well, right. And all you have to do is listen to, I don't know about your radio, but when I listen to the radio, all I hear is cash out, refinance, mm-hmm. commercials, rocket mortgage. That's how it works, is the musical chairs. And that's why you read so often about people in California. Well, we're moving to Arizona. We're moving to Nevada. We're moving to Oregon. Yeah, that works for a while, but it's not sustainable.
Right. Right. Well, absolutely not. So let's talk about these bubbles then. So as far as I'm concerned, a bubble always needs two things, right? You need the story. There's some story. It's eyeballs. Elon Musk is going to, create electric cars for everybody in the world. There's a story, and it's usually got a good nugget of truth buried in it somewhere, and you need credit. And this is the thing, like the tulip bulb crisis mania back in the 1600s in Holland, that couldn't have happened without letters of credit being issued. So you need credit because, again, back to the definition, a bubble occurs when asset prices rise beyond what incomes can sustain, right? And so we can all chortle and laugh about tulip bulbs because obviously, there was no income or cash flow associated with those things. But the same thing is true today in housing, and it just slightly more complicated. So you need the story, you need the credit. Tell what kind of stories need to be told in order for, let's pick on an area. I don't know, let's pick San Francisco Bay Area, where I understand the a local governance board has decided to, if I have the numbers right in my head, this is off the top of my head, but they said, well, to be qualified as a poor family now, to qualify for housing assistance, a family, if they have an income, up to $108,000, they're poor. Here we have an example of a place where it's literally impossible for an average family to own an average house. And yet there's a story that has to go along with that, which says, well, this is reasonable, rational. It's not that the house prices are wrong. There must be something else wrong with the story, so that you have local governance saying, you know what we're going to do? We're going to help people afford the houses, because there's nothing wrong with the house prices. So we'll help them get into affordable housing, with air quotes around that word, affordable. Talk to us about this idea of what the story needs to be and the role of credit in creating these things.
The story is, in the Bay Area, well, we've got all these tech jobs, which, in my opinion, the tech jobs are part of the bubble as well. You got all these companies out there that don't make money, but somehow are worth billions of dollars, basically like bed and breakfast, Airbnb kind of things. But yeah, if you look at the credit, the first thing that happened when the housing bubble popped was Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac increased the loan caps for California. And that happened whenever the jumbo loans went away. So why did the federal government feel a need to increase loan caps for California at a time when prices were collapsing? That made no sense at all. But and now, we find that the federal government is basically guaranteeing not close to 90% of the home loans in the United States. And then, before the housing bubble popped, I think it was in the 70s. 70%. So that's the credit. The credit is endless. It's an endless well that's coming from just the government, the federal government.
Yeah. Well, the headwaters of that particular river, the central banks, but you're right, having Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and also I believe FHA loans. I was surprised how quickly they walked those all the way back to needing a 3% down payment, which is just an insanely low thing. And of course, you know, house prices, if people don't buy the house anymore, they buy the monthly payment, right? So as long as interest rates were falling and they were extremely low, generationally low. My first mortgage was at 12.5% in 1988. So as long as mortgage rates were down there, you know, in the 3.5-4% range, you could afford a lot more house in terms of price. Now that interest rates are rising, we're obviously seeing some stress and some strain. So let's talk about that now, Ben. In your view, A, where do you see bubbles, what you would call housing bubbles? And B, would you agree that many of those are arguably, quantitatively, past peak and starting to fall?
It's hard to say. Just say that it's a much shorter list to say where there's not bubbles.
All right. Well, pick some of the worst ones.
The worst in the world or in the United States?
Just let's take a world tour and then we'll come to the U.S.
Well, Hong Kong, China, Sydney, Australia, Auckland, New Zealand, you know, Dubai, London, I mean, France. But the United States, you know, I would say Seattle, the Bay Area, almost all of Florida, New York, Massachusetts. But, you know, I'm here in Texas right now, and it used to be that, these houses were $30,000, $40,000. And now they're, you know, $250,000, $350,000. And Dallas, which is falling right now. People don't really blink at buying a $250,000 house, spending $10,000 on it, and then putting it back on the market for $350,000. And I got to tell you, the people in Dallas don't make enough money to afford that. And it just got out of control, you know. For whatever reason, these central bankers and the governments did this, and I can't speak for them. I don't know what their motivation was. Well, I have my suspicions, but they just let it get out of control, and that's just, you know, it's really unfortunate. But there's going to be a price to pay. I can tell you that.
Well, let's talk about a place where I think that price is starting to be paid. You have a recent article up about Australia and people starting to panic under the financial strain. You know, as much as I understand, I live in Massachusetts, that we've got a housing bubble here. As bad as it looks here, when I look at what happened in Melbourne and Sydney and places like that, my jaw drops. It absolutely was crazy. And not speaking to the motivations. Listen, the bankers love to get people on the hook for lots of loans. We get that. And of course, they all make crazy money on the way up. And then when things burst, you know, everybody needs, who's going to get the bailout? But the people get swept up in the story. Ben, take us through that story of what's going on in Australia right now. Like what kind of panic are people experiencing?
It's really bad. You know, I've seen Bloomberg reporter in the Financial Times have already called it have said the word global housing bubble. And I think Sydney's income to house prices, you know, they tipped over 10%. And that brings up another thing, which is this whole foreign investor deal. They were building entire towers in like Brisbane and Melbourne that were just to be sold to Chinese investors, right? Sight unseen, never seen, off the plan, what we would call pre-construction condos. and they would sell them out in 2 days. And so now they're being finished and it's collapsing. They got something like a 25% default rate combined with a 20% decline in prices. Well, I get, tell you what, in a year or two, it's going to be a 50% decline in prices, similar to what we saw in Florida with the pre-construction condos back in 2006 and 7. So it's a complete, you know, as far as an economy, it's a disaster in Australia, and they already know it. There's hardly a day that it doesn't just fill their headlines. And, you know, that's kind of gets to the strange concept about what I've said about the housing bubble was the most important things happened after 2007 and 8, which was quantitative easing, what the central banks did, because that set off a commodity boom centered around China. I don't know if you remember, they said that China in 2009 and 10 poured as much concrete in 3 years as the United States did in 100.
I know.
Well, that set off this huge commodity boom, which then fed this commodity explosion in Australia and in Canada. So then you had these mining areas in Australia and oil boom, oil shale things in Canada, these little towns and cities in Australia, for instance, their median house prices went to $900,000, and now they're down, you know, like as much as 80%. So that was really, you know, what happened with the commodities actually created kind of like this. It's hard to even explain, but it was what happened after 2008. Was more important than what happened with the subprime, et cetera, before, because it exacerbated this housing bubble and spread it, you know, into Nigeria, for instance, with all the oil. Now you've got massive declines all over the world because they were built. That was another story, you know, was this, oh, well, commodities. Well, commodities are what hammered, you know, a commodity bubble is what hammered Texas in the 80s. And nevertheless, everything kind of comes down to what people can afford. And boom or not, well, booms turn to bust. That's just the way it goes.
Well, I totally agree. And of course, you know, we said the bubble needs two things. You need that story, you need that credit. You know, in Australia, I talked to a lot of people from Australia over the years, and they said, many of them sort of knew what they were in, but sort of shrugged and said, well, as long as everything's, you know, all the house prices are going up and it's crazy here and you don't understand and there's just no inventory and all that stuff, you still need that credit. And when you issue credit, what you're doing is you're pulling forward consumption to today from the future. And so eventually that credit has to get paid back. And that means that whether you were consuming commodities today, they don't get consumed in the future because you're paying that back. However you look at that, there's less demand in the future. And if enough credit gets wiped out, of course, you have deep, deep problems. You get systemic banking issues, all that stuff. So I'm looking at Australia now, where we're seeing that median house prices have dropped from 1.2 million down to 1 million in a year. Yeah, that's a $200,000 drop. Foreclosures are up by 600% in some regions. So we're clearly seeing that their past peak, and my advice, and I'd see if you would share this, my advice to anybody who's got real estate in Australia who wants to move it is don't be shy, drop the price until it sells and get the heck out of the way. That would be my advice here. What would yours be?
Well, you know, like from a pedestrian standpoint, yeah, run for the hills. But, you know, the way I look at it is more like, well, who are you going to sell it to? Well, some sucker. And that's fine, you know. But the way I look at this whole thing is like is not from like an individual standpoint. It's like, well, what does the housing bubble mean to the economy? And so you got winners and losers, and that's fine. Be one or don't be one. But the problem is that we're in this situation from the get-go. And, yeah, I mean, I guess you could say, yeah, let's bail out and let some other guy be the bag holder. But what I would prefer to focus on is, like, how can we not get into this situation again? What needs to be changed? And I think that the problem, the root problem is that for whatever reason, we've gotten into a situation where houses are supposed to be some kind of creation of wealth, when, as you said, they're not. They're a house is an expense. I'm a property manager, and I can tell you every day is an expense, and housing is it needs to go back to what it used to be, which is something that we consume that requires investment, maintenance. It shouldn't be this big bonanza. There shouldn't be, for instance, I was astounded to find out that the housing TV reality shows are a multi-billion dollar industry worldwide, especially in like Australia and New Zealand. I mean, they used to basically worship housing, and its role, it was just astounding. And that just shouldn't be. There shouldn't be TV show reality shows about housing. It wasn't that way 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah. Well, this is, you know, if we back up a bit, and you asked an important question, which is, look, how do we avoid this in the future? And believe me, I put a lot of blame at the feet of the bankers, but also, you know, the homeowners really who are participating in this have to bear some of the responsibility. But that's kind of hard to say. Like, if you live in Seattle and you've got a job and you really want to own a home, and what do? You either participate or you don't, and you either pay the prices that exist there or you don't. So in some ways, I think, you know, here's where homeowners bear responsibility in this. When they really, really stretch, when they think they're going to flip the home for more, when they have their eye on the capital gains that they're going to make off of this, you know, when they extract equity from their house because they're worth so much more, those are things that really ought not to be done on average, especially during a bubble. So if we back up and ask that important question, how do we avoid this again? Look, we have an everything bubble in the world. As burned as people are going to get on real estate, wait till you see what happens to the junk bond and the leveraged loan markets. Oh my God, you know, just trillions of losses coming. In the equity markets, this is the everything bubble. Every major financial asset class, real estate, stocks, bonds, got driven through the roof because the central bank said, hey, we think we can, you know, we blew up a credit a cycle in 2000. Really unfortunate, but we learned our lesson. We just had to double down. Bernanke gave us a next layer of that. We had more participation by the world central banks. China got on board with that. Unbelievable how much money was printed through all of that. And now we're in our third credit cycle. This one blows up. Ben, all I can tell you is that if we're smart and this is painful enough, what we do is we decide that we can't let central bankers drive credit cycles as the policy instrument. It's damaging. It's stupid. And it always ends in tears. I think this time it ends in much more tears than 2008, just because, like I said, there's really nowhere to hide. Even at the height of 2007, at this, you know, I was writing about the bubble in housing and certain equities as well. There were still places to hide. There's nowhere to hide. Everything got overpriced, you know, except for certain commodities in this cycle. So beyond that, I just think, you know, my advice to people is know where you are in the bubble, stay oriented. And for goodness sakes, get out of the way of it if you can. I don't know what else to tell you at this point.
Well, also, just whenever you hear crazy talk, just recognize it for what it is. For instance, it was 2016, people were telling us that negative interest rates were the future.
Yeah.
This is the way it's going to be. Oh, you're going to pay me to borrow money? You know, it was ludicrous on the face of it. And yet it was accepted by, you know, how many media organizations and talking heads, and look where it's went. And you talk about trillions. There's already been trillions of dollars lost on sovereign debt that was issued at negative interest rates. The media won't tell you that, but it's already gone. Trillions of dollars have been lost on negative interest rate bonds.
Yep. Yep. Who could have? Who knew? Who knew that paying Portugal to lend it money was a bad idea? Who could have figured that out?
Right. And one thing you touched upon, I want to mention is that the house buyers themselves, one of the most important things I ever came across was Peter Schiff mentioned that people are how many different ways that people speculate on housing when they don't really know that they're speculating. And a perfect example is if you refinance your house and you don't really need to, you know, you basically sold it to the bank. Well, you got to pay that back. Well, why would you do that? In most cases, these people don't expect to have to pay it back. Whenever I was in the foreclosure business for 8 years, and I did a lot of research on the houses as they came across my desk. And a lot of times these people were refinancing 2, 3, 4 times. And this was in Flagstaff, Arizona. So they were refinancing every year. And a lot of times pulling out $80,000, $100,000 at a whack. Why would you do that when you know you have to pay it back? Well, they were expecting that they were never going to pay it back. So they were speculating. And it's the same with a lot of people like on Mercer Island in Washington. Why would you pay 10 times your income for a house? Well, because you expect it to go up. And another example is the way that in Santa Clara and in Palo Alto, where I've posted stories of in Palo Alto that they're whacking $1 million off the price and it won't get an offer. Whereas before, you know, they were getting multiple offers, et cetera. You don't really need a $5 million house. Why would you buy a $5 million house? Because you expect to sell it for $7 million.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of speculation that's kind of going under the radar that, well, housing is a good investment. And it's like, well, it's not a good investment, but that's, you know, we can debate that. But the fact is that nobody really needs a $5 million Santa Clara house, which is really kind of an ordinary house. They could live in $1 million house, right? Even if you believe that housing was worth $5 million, they actually expect it to be this big bonanza. And I guess the takeaway is that there's a lot more speculation going on in the market than most people acknowledge.
Well, sure. And when that speculation comes to an end, there's a usual pattern of things. So what are you looking for? Like, if you had advice for somebody who's like thinking, you know, is now the right time to buy? And a lot of people, of course, are in that decision set right now because, you know, people move. But what would you be looking at in terms of inventory or months on the market or how the prices and various subcomponents are moving? What would you look at to say, now this would be I should probably wait a little longer in this market? What would those indicators be?
Well, yeah, that brings up something that kind of I think is funny, is this months on the market thing. Like, I posted an article yesterday about the months on the market. Where was it? Going from 10 days to 15 days. And now it was a buyer's market. Obviously, the months on the market thing is meaningless. I mean, I call it the real estate industrial complex.
Yep.
These guys. I don't want to say what I think about them, frankly. But the months on the market doesn't mean anything. The inventory. Well, I would say right now the bubble is popping in the United States, and until interest rates settle out and these prices settle down, I'm an investor. I'm a real estate investor, and I'm getting ready to sit on the fence like a vulture, because that's what's going to happen here. It's really unfortunate, but we are going to see a collapse. We are seeing a collapse. So the real estate market, the bubble has popped right now. You can tell mostly because, let's take the Bay Area in California. Prices are falling, and yet everybody's rushing to sell. And purchases are dropping like a rock. It's the exact opposite. When prices go down, people should buy more, but mm-hmm. They're not. Everybody's behaving like speculators. It's just like it's day trading stocks or something. So what's happening in the market right now has a lot more in common with, or suggests a bubble much more than it does just a correction or a cycle. And that's, I don't know. I mean, I can't think of a market in the United States that I would buy in right now.
All right. So as you sit like a vulture, though, you might have to be patient. You know, bubbles take time. I know they tend to fall a little quicker than they go up, but still, housing's a little slower than stocks and bonds. Well, a lot slower than stocks and bonds, mostly because you've got real people and the sales cycle is slow. And I just remember, you know, even in 2008, people just hanging on and grudgingly lowering their price by $5,000 increments when a $50,000 whack was what was needed. So there's a little bit of a slower trajectory on that. Would you agree with that? And two, is it possible, though, that because people have that recent memory of a decade ago, that they might be a little quicker this time?
Well, yeah, there's plenty of people that have a memory of how this is going to play out, and they're actually probably all lining up the same way. But what you want to do, you don't want to buy from Joe Sixpack. What you want to buy is from a bank or a lender, and that's going to be Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. For instance, in 2010, I helped somebody buy a house for, I think, $12,000 as an online auction. And that house had refinanced 4 years before for over $100,000. And that same day, we could have bought three more for the same, for, you know, like $10,000, $12,000. So that's what you want. The lenders are going to be the ones that give you the big discounts. Wait until the distress sales. You don't want to be buying retail and real estate.
So I've never done that process, Ben. So take me through that. If how would I do? How's that work? Do you develop a relationship with a bank, or is there just a machine and there's a way that they do it, and you have to figure out how that machine works, and you show up with all the other people who understands how that machine works, or do you follow individual foreclosures in a key market area and then make calls? How does that work?
Well, there's a lot. There's actually a ton of different ways it works. Sheriff sales, trustee sales. That's the first level. That's in states like Texas and Arizona. That's the actual foreclosure. So they have to go through this process where they say, well, it's anybody can buy it, including the current owner. And they'll put a price on it. That's usually what's owed.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever you see them selling it for less than what's owed, that's when there's some blood on the street. So then a lot of times, you know, in a falling market, it won't sell at that price. So then there's that's the post foreclosure. And that's when, you know, the rubber hits the road. And so they're going to put it on just on the market. They obviously want to market it to the largest number of people.
Yep.
And that's when, you know, you remember back in the day when there was a ton of foreclosures on the market, right?
Yep.
So that's that post foreclosure market. So, you know, I used to go to a lot of sheriff sales and trustee sales, and, you know, it's a waste of time. You just, uh-huh. You know, wait until that foreclosure has been sitting on the market for about 6 months and they've whacked it down, you know, 8 or 9 times, and then, go in and make a low ball offer. And it's not, another thing to realize is that these guys that are selling these are not, it's not Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They hire asset managers.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys, they're professionals at getting rid of the houses, and they've got so much to spend on them and so much to get rid of, you know, so much that they can lose, basically. And that's where we're headed again. And yeah, I would be very patient right now about catching a falling knife.
And if I was interested, Ben, in figuring out that whole process, what's a good way to go about learning about all that?
Well, you could follow my blog.
All right.
But I would just dive into it. I mean, like there's HUD with the HUD system. HUD is going to have a lot of foreclosures. They always do, because that's what they are. They're basically kind of a subprime outfit. You can just follow along the HUD foreclosures and just watch how it goes. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they have the same thing, but they're less transparent. What I would suggest you kind of watch out for is the auction.com outfits.
Yep.
They're, I can just say, in my opinion, from having watched them, is that they do bids on the behalf of the lenders. So, for instance, once we won a bid where we were the lead bid, and within like 2 minutes of the closing, this bid came in $10,000 higher, and we were like, well, who would do that? You know, who would bid $10,000 higher at the last second? You know, and digging into it, later on we found out, you know, that the website had reserved the right to make bids on behalf of the seller. So, you know, bidding online is difficult, and well, I guess it's like anything, you know, and it kind of becomes a dog eat dog thing.
Yeah, it sounds like eBay with an undisclosed reserve minimum. You know,
it's really unfortunate. You know, I mean, it's definitely buyer beware.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I've been advising my listeners for a long time that there are better prices in the future, and that everybody should, if you want to get involved in real estate or you want to buy different stocks or bonds, whatever you want, get your buy list, do your homework, begin that process of due diligence, understand what you would want under what circumstances, and then be patient. So this is an area that I would really like to, personally, I'm going to be following, and I'd like to be alerting my listeners to as well, which is this idea that if you want to be in real estate, there's a lot of legwork, a lot of homework. You got to do your due diligence. Just this past fall, I looked at 70 separate properties here in Western Massachusetts. Couldn't find any of them that looked even remotely compelling. The prices were ridiculous, but I learned a lot about what was out there and what the market was. And we've got different key markets with 5 universities. So there's a story about professors and students. And then we've got a different story around the surrounding town. So just working that all through is really important. But I think I've got a pretty good sense of the market now, and I'll keep building that sense as I go forward. I would not personally be participating in this market right now here, but I know under what circumstances I would. So I like that idea, and we'll be following that, and as well your blog, which so Ben, we're out of time for today, but first, thank you for your time. Please remind people where they can find your work and continue tracking the bubble.
It's housingbubble.blog.
Housingbubble.blog. And great articles there. You can track everything that's going on around that. And it's just fantastic. So, hey, good luck being a vulture on a fence. I'll be right there with you. I know some people listening will as well. And we'll be continuing to track this. So, Ben, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.